So I have sought to evoke the main locations of Augustus's career, as they were at the time and as they appear today. Among them, his house on the Palatine, the secret palace on the island of Pandateria, the low, sandy headland of Actium, and the spectacular city of Alexandria. The Roman world is still recognisable to us who live 2 millennia later. The day-to-day practice of politics, the realities of urban living, the seaside resorts, the cultivation of the arts, the rising divorce rate, the misdemeanours of the younger generation, past and present, have many things in common. However, certain forms of degradation, slavery, the low status of women, and the gladiatorial carnage of the arena shock and astonish us. So, too, does the moral approval accorded to military violence and imperial expansion. Julius Caesar's largely unprovoked conquest of Gaul was hailed at Rome as a wonderful achievement, but it is estimated that 1 million Gauls lost their lives in the fighting. Augustus was a very great man, but he grew gradually into greatness. He did not possess Julius Caesar's bravura and political genius. It was that genius, of course, which killed Caesar, for it made him incapable of compromise. He was a physical coward who taught himself to be brave. He was intelligent, painstaking and patient, but could also be cruel and ruthless. He worked extraordinarily hard. He thought in the long term, achieving his aims slowly and by trial and error. Augustus is one of the few historical figures who improved with the passage of time. He began as a bloodthirsty adventurer, but once he had achieved power, he made a respectable man of himself. He repealed his illegal acts and took trouble to govern fairly and efficiently. One curious aspect of Augustus's life is that many of the leading players were very young men. The adults who started Rome's civil wars fell victim to long years of fighting, leaving the baton to be picked up by the next generation. Augustus and his schoolmates, Maecenas and Agrippa, were in their late teens when they took charge of the state. Pompey the Great's son, Sextus, was probably much the same age when he set himself up as a guerrilla leader in Spain. Augustus died old, but throughout his long reign, he never hesitated to entrust great responsibility to the young men of his family, his stepsons Tiberius and Drusus, and his grandsons Gaius and Lucius. The excitement of making one's way in an adult world must have been intoxicating. We are right to call Augustus Rome's first emperor, yet the title is anachronistic. At the time, he was simply regarded as the chief man in the state. The Roman Republic had apparently been restored, not abolished. Augustus developed a personality cult, but he did not hold permanent authority and had to have his powers regularly renewed. Only with the accession of Tiberius did people finally realize that they were no longer citizens of a free commonwealth, but subjects living under a permanent monarchy. So nowhere in this book do I call Augustus emperor. The task of writing a life of Augustus is complicated by the fact that many contemporary sources are lost, casualties of the Dark Ages. The autobiography down to 25 BC that Augustus wrote in Spain, his correspondence with Cicero, Agrippa's memoirs, the history of his times by Pollio, and Marcellus' commentaries on the civil wars after Julius Caesar's assassination. 30 books of Livy's Great History of Rome, covering the period from 44 to 9 BC. Only fragments of the life of Augustus written by a friend of Herod the Great, Nicolaus of Damascus, have survived. And Appian's detailed study of Rome's civil wars in the 1st century BC closes with the death of Sextus Pompeius, in 35 BC. Dio Cassius gives a reasonably complete account in his Roman history, but his style is pedestrian, and he wrote 300 years after the event. The findings of the modern archaeologists, especially inscriptions and coins, add valuable information.